Today, upping the ante 10 years later. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 15th September 2018. Our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon programme, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here's the link, and it's also in the comments below. On the 10th anniversary of the failure of Lehman Brothers, the consensus seems to be that the financial system is still stressed under the impact of sky-high global debt, artificially low interest rates, and asset bubbles. The shadow is long and the risks high. I discussed this on ABC Radio Sydney and also in a video post with Robbie Barwick from the CEC. Perhaps of most concern is the lack of acceptance that we have a problem, with the RBA this week recognising that household debt is high, but declaring it manageable, and the Housing Industry Association calling for a relaxation of lending standards to support housing construction. That is, in my view, the last thing we need. The truth is, pressure on households and tighter lending standards means more price falls will follow. Those who follow my analysis will know I run four different scenarios, including the one, the worst case, where prices could drop 40 to 45% from their highs over the next few years. This, of course, is the angle which the upcoming 60 Minutes programme, to be aired tomorrow, Sunday, is driving at.
Now we've had on the market for 18 months and still not sold. You know, it's something which you think about all day.
If you have a mortgage, this is a 60 Minutes you must watch.
It loses out big in the next couple of years.
Because it's about to get very ugly.
Property prices 40 to 45% down.
It's your future, your money.
Banks are going to cover their own ass.
The order went out explicitly. Do not talk to 60 Minutes.
If they foresee that they can get their money back before everyone else, then they will do so.
We'll tell you what the banks are up to this time.
And at some point, it's going to explode in our face.
What homeowners need to do.
Reality check is coming.
And fast. 60 Minutes, Sunday.
Just remember that this is one of four scenarios, but it's rated a 20% probability now. There was more evidence this week as to the issues under the hood. For example, Domain says that whilst housing affordability has improved in all capital cities where property prices have started to decline, the median multiple is still well above affordable housing thresholds in several capital city markets. They say that drawing on Domain price data and adjusted census income data, the change in price and the median multiple across capital city markets since the respective peaks was analysed. While the house price to income ratio is a simple standard indicator for understanding affordability, particularly across countries, it is far from comprehensive. Other affordability metrics still spell out tough times ahead for homeowners, though. Rental affordability, mortgage serviceability, and the deposit hurdle are also vital considerations. But Domain says that as at June 2018, data shows that the median income household in Sydney would require 59.8% of weekly income to service an owner-occupied mortgage, assuming a 5.2% variable rate on a loan-to-value income ratio of 80%. This is down from 64.4% at the peak of the latest cycle. Another angle is credit scoring, as Banking Day called out, as the remaining three big four banks are reportedly getting ready to join NAB as participants in the new comprehensive credit reporting regime. This means a massive database will share their customers' full credit history with each other, and for the first time from the end of this month, at which point comprehensive credit reporting will be a foregone conclusion with the remaining major banks. The new data sharing regime will allow lenders to better verify loan applicants and assess credit risk by assessing the full repayment history of a potential customer, including their total debts. The major lenders have pushed ahead with the changes following pressure from the prudential regulator. The Australian reported that ANZ said it had been testing positive data reporting since the end of June, although the data was not shared with the public at this stage. The big banks' embrace of the new regime would put pressure on others to sign up, since only lenders who supply comprehensive reporting to the credit bureaus would access data, the Australian Retail Credit Association chairman Mike Lang told The Australian. If they don't join, then people who intend to borrow money but not pay it back will quickly find out which ones are not in the system, and they will go to the lenders who don't have access to the verifiable data. So it's risky for a lender not to take part once most of the data is in there. And yet another angle. Between 2008 and 2012, the number of self-managed superannuation funds grew by 27% to nearly 500,000. That was more than 40% of the growth of the whole superannuation system. The global financial crisis coincided with the Howard government lifting the ban on superannuation funds borrowing money. And as a result, self-managed super funds have rushed to take advantage and racked up $32 billion in debt in little more than a decade. The Financial System Inquiry in 2014 recommended that borrowings by superannuation funds be banned. And it's a view shared by Saul Eslake, the former ANZ Bank chief economist, who describes the decision to allow super funds to borrow as the dumbest tax policy of the last two decades. The last thing Australians really needed in the last 20 years is yet another vehicle or incentive for Australians to borrow more money in order to speculate on property prices continuing to rise, Mr. Eslake said. Overlaying that is the perennial problem of property spruikers trying to persuade people to borrow big to buy and tip their newly acquired heavily leveraged property into a self-managed superfund. Superfund borrowing is known as limited recourse, which means that if the fund can't pay off the loan, the bank can't go after other assets, just the property in question. And remember, this was at the heart of the subprime mortgage fiasco 10 years ago, which morphed into the global financial crisis. Whilst not wanting to be alarmist, Saul Eslake is concerned with what he's seeing now in self-managed super funds with their limited recourse borrowing. You might have thought that someone would have heard the term limited recourse borrowing and recognised that there were some significant risks associated with it that we could have done without in the Australian context, he said. And CoreLogic reported that the combined capital city returned a final auction clearance rate of 55.3% last week, a slight improvement on the 55% over the week prior, when volumes were a little lower. There were 1,916 homes taken to auction last week, up on the 1,748 held the previous week. While 1 year ago, a higher 2,258 auctions were held, with a 66.9% success rate. Melbourne returned a final auction clearance rate of 60% this week, an improvement not only over the week, but the highest seen since May, with clearance rates for the city remaining within the mid to high 50% range up until this week. The improved clearance rate was across a higher volume of auctions week on week, with 891 auctions held, increasing on the 805 held the week prior, when 57% sold. Sydney's final auction clearance rate came in at 50.6% last week across 656 auctions, falling on the week prior when a 53.8% clearance rate was returned and auction volumes were similar, 664. As usual, the performance across the smaller auction markets was mixed last week, with clearance rates improving in Adelaide, Brisbane and Canberra, while Perth's final clearance rate fell. The Gold Coast region was the busiest non-capital city region last week, with 56 homes taken to auction, although only 24.6% sold, and Geelong was the best performing in terms of clearance rates at 88% of the 34 auctions successful. And this week, CoreLogic is tracking 1,882 capital city auctions. If we compare activity the same week last year, volumes are down 25% on the 2,510 auctions held 1 year ago. And finally, APRA released their quarterly property exposure data to June this past week. There are some interesting data points and some concerning trends and loosening of standards recently. I'm going to focus on the new loan flows here. First, the rise in loans outside serviceability continues to rise. Now, 6% of major banks are in this category, a record, reflecting first tightening of lending standards, but second also their willingness to break their own rules. This should be ringing alarm bells. APRA? Foreign banks are writing the greater share in relative percentage terms of 80 to 90% LVR loans. Other lenders are tracking lower. And foreign banks are lending more 90% plus LVR loans in relative percentage terms. New investor loans are moving a little higher for credit unions and major banks, suggesting a growth in volumes. And the share of interest-only loans dropped below 20%, but it is now rising a little as lenders seek to grow their books. All warning signs, especially as APRA reports ADI's residential term loans to households were $1.62 trillion as at the 30th of June 2018, and this is an increase of $86.6 billion or 5.6% on the 30th of June 2017, still well above inflation. Of these, owner-occupied loans were $1.076 trillion, 66.4%, an increase of $76.7 billion, which is up 7.7% from the 30th of June 2017. And investor loans were $544 billion at 33.6%, an increase of $9.9 billion, 1.9% higher than the 30th of June 2017. So debt is still sky high and growing very fast. The rate must be slowed further, and there are rumours of more tightening to come. We will see. Looking at the local markets, the ASX 100 was down at the end of the week. It ended up at 5,065.90, up 29.8 on the day. And it continues to underperform compared with the US markets. In the banking sector, NAB ended the week at 27.35 after they announced they would not follow the lead of Westpac, CBA and ANZ, for now at least, by not lifting their variable mortgage rates. NAB closed up 0.18% on the day. ANZ, who it was announced would be subject to civil proceedings from ASIC for an alleged continuous disclosure breach in relation to a $2.5 billion institutional share placement that they took in 2015, their shares rose 0.32% on Friday to 28.15. CBA, who took some further knocks this week thanks to further evidence of poor practice in Commonshaw, in the Banking Royal Commission, among others in the industry, I might add, they ended the week at 71.50 and up 0.45%. And Westpac ended the week at 27.76, up 0.69% on Friday. Despite the relatively benign employment figures out this week, still at 5.3%, the Aussie ended the week at 71.54 and closed down 0.57% on Friday. The downward trajectory is clearly in play. This risks importing inflation into the local economy. Looking across to the USA, many investors may be inclined to dismiss yet another headline on global trade and focus on the more granular aspects of the markets. But make no mistake, the markets were gyrating with the twists in the saga between the US and its trading partners. The latest salvo came on Friday when Bloomberg reported that Trump instructed aides the day before to proceed with tariffs on another $200 billion in Chinese products, but that the announcements had been delayed as the administration considers revisions based on concerns raised in public comments. Earlier in the week, China had welcomed an invitation by the United States to hold a new round of trade talks. The Trump administration had invited Chinese officials to restart trade talks, the White House top economic advisor said on Wednesday. And in addition to these tariffs, Trump has said he's ready to add an additional $267 billion in tariffs on short notice, if I want. Earlier in the week, Beijing indicated it would ask the World Trade Organization for permission to impose sanctions on the US as part of a dispute over US dumping duties that China started in 2013. And there's still the revamp of NAFTA to consider. The US and Canada have been in talks to bring Canada into a new agreement between the US and Mexico, but there have been no announcements so far. Talks are expected to continue on Monday. Beyond the US manufacturing sector, for example, Boeing is still pretty strong at 359.80, while Caterpillar ended down 0.44% to 144.90. The potential spillover into the consumer sector impacted a range of stocks, with Whirlpool down 1.68% to 123.21, Walmart down 0.56% to 94.59, and Mattel up 1.49% to 16.35. Among the financials, Morgan Stanley was at 48.19, a little higher on the day, but still well down on their March highs. The S&P 500 ended up 0.03% to 2,904.98, as did the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which ended at 26,154, while the Nasdaq was down just a little to 8,010. Apple got the type of promotional attention some companies can only dream of when the eyes of the tech lovers and investors alike were glued to its keynote event for details of its new products, especially phones. Apple announced on Wednesday its new iPhone product line. Shares of Apple rose the day before the event in anticipation of the kind of surprise announcement for which CEO Steve Jobs was famous. The stock sold off as details of the new iPhones arrived, and shares ended the day lower. But shares then bounced back on Thursday, leading the overall tech sector higher, despite negative analyst commentary about the price of iPhone XR. Apple ended the week down 1.14% to $223.84. Bucking the recent trend that made investors nervous about price pressure, the latest data showed inflation cooling. First figures showed wholesale prices fell unexpectedly. Producer price index decreased 0.1% last month, and in the 12 months through to August, the PPI rose 2.8%. Economists had forecast the PPI would rise 0.2% last month and would increase 3.2% from the year ago. Next, retail inflation rose less than anticipated. The consumer price index advanced 0.2%, missing expectations for a gain of 0.3%. And in the 12 months through to July, the CPI increased 2.7%, below forecasts of a reading of 2.8% and down from 2.9% in July. But despite these softer inflation numbers, traders ended the week still predicting a more than 80% chance of the Federal Reserve hiking rates in its December meeting, on top of the expected boost in September. Bond yields rose sharply this week, owing to confidence that the Federal Reserve will lift rates for a total four times this year. The rise was particularly strong on Friday when the US 10-year yield topped 3% briefly. The big reason for that was Friday's retail sales numbers. The August retail sales numbers were disappointing at first blush, rising at 0.1% compared with the expectation of 0.4%, but July's gain was revised up to 0.7% from 0.5%. That revision gave market watchers some more confidence that the US could see GDP growth of 4% in the third quarter, which would all but guarantee another rise in rates in December. Gold ended the week lower at $1,198, down 0.82%, with preference for the US dollar as a safe haven. And copper fell 2.61%, well down on the start of the year, with demand slowing. Oil prices were higher to $69, up 0.60% on Friday, reflecting concerns about supply, thanks to Hurricane Florence, and trade concerns. Of course, with the lower Aussie, this means fuel prices will rise further ahead. And finally, Bitcoin is still making lower highs, even though the cryptocurrency has been slightly higher lows. The key is going to be when Bitcoin trades back above $7,000. There is a trend line connecting all the recent highs going back to early 2018. If Bitcoin can bust above that level, it will likely take out the high at $7,350 and make a higher high beyond that. Once that happens, institutions may start buying heavily, and the upside, they say, could be back above $10,000 within months. We will see. That said, it ended the week down 1.15% to 6,488. According to Bloomberg, Morgan Stanley plans to offer trading in complex derivatives tied to the largest cryptocurrency, according to a person familiar with the matter, joining other Wall Street firms in creating ways for clients to play the digital currency markets. The US bank will deal in contracts that give investors synthetic exposure to the performance of Bitcoin, said the person who asked not to be identified because the information is private. Investors will be able to go long or short using the so-called price return swaps, and Morgan Stanley will charge a spread for each transaction, the person said. Citigroup is developing a new mechanism for trading cryptocurrencies known as digital asset receipts, a person with knowledge of the plans said earlier this month. And Goldman Sachs is exploring derivatives on Bitcoin called non-deliverable forwards and is considering a plan to offer custody for crypto funds. All of this illustrates how some of the major players are considering piling in to Bitcoin to try and make a buck. Finally today, a couple of quick reminders. First, the 60 Minutes program tomorrow evening and our live stream event on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney, where you can discuss with me the latest on the outlook for home prices, as well as all our other analysis. You can bookmark the event by using this link. I look forward to your questions in the live chat. And if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our abilities to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've heard here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, a principal analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.